Don't you think you'll want to keep a low profile, you know, being a fugitive and all? Laurie answered for him.
No, they're going to forget all about him, and he's going to have a long, happy, wonderful life in Argentina with a beautiful woman who dances the tango, and Jacob will be a great man.
She got up on her knees so she could look at his face and continued to stroke his hair as he lay there.
He'll have children, and his children will have children, and he'll bring so much happiness to so many people that no one will ever believe that once upon a time in America, people said horrible things about him.
Jacob closed his eyes.
I don't know if I can go to court tomorrow. I just don't want to do it anymore.
I know, Jake. I laid my palm on his chest. It's almost over.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Laurie,
I don't think I can do it anymore either.
It'll be over soon. We just have to hang in there, I promise.
Dad, you'll tell me, right? Like you said? If it's time for me to...
He cocked his head toward the door. I suppose I could have told him the truth. It's not like that, Jake. There's nowhere to go. But I didn't. I said, it's not going to happen. We're going to win.
But if...
If, yeah, definitely, I'll tell you, Jacob. I tousled his hair. Let's try to get some sleep.
Laurie kissed his forehead, and I did the same. He said, maybe you guys will come to Buenos Aires, too. We can all go.
Can we still order from China City there?
Sure, Dad, he grinned. We'll fly it in.
Okay, then. For a second, I didn't think it was a realistic plan. Now, get some sleep. Another big day tomorrow.
Let's hope not, he said.
When Laurie and I got into bed, she said in a pillow talk murmur,
when we were talking about Buenos Aires, that was the first time I felt happy in I don't know how long. I don't remember the last time I smiled.
But her confidence must have faltered, because only a few seconds later, as she lay on her side facing me, she whispered,
what if he went to Buenos Aires and killed someone there?
Laurie, he's not going to Buenos Aires, and he's not going to kill anyone. He didn't kill anyone here.
I'm not so sure.
Don't say that. She looked away. Laurie?
Andy, what if we're the ones who are wrong? What if he gets off and then, God forbid, he does it again? Don't we have some responsibility?
Laurie, it's late. You're exhausted. We'll have this conversation some other time. For now, you need to stop thinking that way. You're making yourself crazy.
No.
She gave me an imploring look, like I was the one who was not making sense.
Andy, we need to be honest with each other. This is something we need to think about.
Why, the trial isn't over yet. You're quitting too soon.
We need to think about it because he's our son. He needs our support.
Laurie, we're doing our job. We're supporting him. We're helping him get through the trial.
Is that our job?
Yes. What else is there?
What if he needs something else, Andy?
There is nothing else. What are you talking about? There's nothing more we can do. We're already doing everything humanly possible.
Andy, what if he's guilty?
He won't be. Her breathy whispering became intense, pointed.
I don't mean the verdict. I mean the truth. What if he really is guilty?
He isn't.
Andy, is that what you really think? He didn't do it? Simple as that? You have no doubt at all?
I did not answer. I could not bear to.
Andy, I can't read you anymore. You need to talk to me. You need to tell me. I'm never sure what's going on inside you anymore.
Nothing's going on inside me, I said, and the statement felt even truer than I'd intended.
Andy, sometimes I just want to grab you by the lapels and make you tell the truth.
Oh, the thing with my father again.
No, it's not that. I'm talking about Jacob. I need you to be absolutely honest here. For me, I need to know. Even if you don't, I need to know. Do you think Jacob did it?
I think there are things a parent should never think about a child.
That's not what I asked.
Lori, he's my son.
He's our son. We're responsible for him.
Exactly. We're responsible for him. We need to stick with him. I put my hand on her head, stroked her hair. She swiped it away.
No, Andy, do you understand what I'm saying to you? If he's guilty, then we're guilty too. That's just the way it is. We're implicated. We made him, you and me. We created him and we sent him out into the world. And if he really did this, can you handle that? Can you handle that possibility?
If I have to.
Really, Andy? Could you?
Yes. Look, if he's guilty, if we lose, then we'll have to face that somehow.
I mean, I get that.
We'll still be his parents. You can't resign from this job.
Andy, you're the most infuriating, dishonest man.
Why?
Because I need you to be here with me right now, and you're not.
I am.
No, you're managing me. You're talking in platitudes. You're there behind those handsome brown eyes, and I don't know what you're really thinking. I can't tell.
I sighed, shook my head. Sometimes I can't tell either, Lori. I don't know what I'm thinking. I'm trying not to think at all.
Andy, please, you have to think. Look inside yourself. You're his father. You can't avoid this. Did he do it? It's a yes or no question.
She was pushing me toward it, this towering black idea, Jacob the murderer. I brushed against it, touched the hem of its robe, and I could not go any further. The danger was too great. I said, I don't know.
Then you think he might have.
I don't know.
But it's possible, at least.
I said, I don't know, Lori. She scrutinized my face, my eyes, searching for something she could trust, for bedrock. I tried to put on a mask of resolve for her so she would find in my expression whatever it was she needed, reassurance, love, connection, whatever. But the truth? Certainty? I did not have those. They were not mine to give. A couple of hours later, around 1 a.m., there was a siren in the distance. This was unusual. In our quiet suburb, the cops and fire engines generally do not use them, flashers only. The siren lasted only 5 seconds or so, then resonated in the quiet, suspended like a flare. Behind me, Lori was asleep in the same position as before, with her back to me. I went to the window and looked out, but there was nothing to see. I would not find out until the next morning what that siren was and how, unknown to us, everything had changed. We were already in Argentina. Chapter 36. Hell of a Show. The phone rang at 5:30 the next morning, my cell phone, and I answered it automatically, conditioned over the years to receive these emergency calls at crazy hours. I even answered in my old commanding voice, Andy Barber, to convince people that I had not actually been sleeping no matter what the hour. When I hung up, Lori said, "Who was that?"
"Jonathan."
"What's wrong?"
"Nothing."
"So what was it for?" I felt a grin spread over my face, and a dreamy, bewildered happiness embraced me.
"Andy?"
"It's over."
"What do you mean it's over?"
"He confessed."
"What? Who confessed?"
"Pats."
"What?"
"Jonathan did what he said he would in court. He had him served. Pats got the subpoena, and last night he killed himself. He left a note with a full confession. Jonathan said they'd been at his apartment all night. They confirmed the handwriting. The note is legit. Pats confessed."
"He confessed? Just like that? Is that possible?"
"It doesn't seem real, does it?"
How did he kill himself?"
"Hung himself."
"Oh, my God.
Jonathan says he's going to move for dismissal as soon as court opens." Lori's hands covered her mouth. She was already crying. We embraced, then we ran into Jacob's room as if it were Christmas morning, or Easter, given that this miracle was more in the nature of a resurrection,
and we shook him awake and hugged him and shared the incredible news. And everything was different. Just like that, everything was different. We got dressed in our trial clothes and we bided our time till we could drive down to the courthouse. We watched the news on TV and checked Boston.com for mention of Pat's suicide, but there was none, so we sat there grinning at one another and shaking our heads in disbelief. It was better than a not guilty from the jury. We kept saying this. Not guilty is merely a failure of proof. Jacob had actually been proven innocent. It was as if the entire horrific episode was erased. I do not believe in God or miracles, but this was a miracle. I cannot explain the feeling in any other way. It felt as if we had been saved by some sort of divine intervention, by a real miracle. The only limit on our joy was the fact that we could not quite believe it, and we did not want to celebrate until the case was officially dismissed. It was at least conceivable, after all, that LeJudas would continue his prosecution even in the face of Pat's confession. In the event, Jonathan did not get the chance to move for dismissal. Before the judge even took the bench, LeJudas filed a nolle pros, a nolle prosequi, which announced the government's decision to drop the charges. At 9 sharp, the judge bounded out to the bench with a little grin. He read over the nolle pros with a theatrical flourish, and with a palm-up motion of his hand, he asked Jacob to stand. "Mr. Barber, I see from your face and from your dad's face that you've already heard the news, so let me be the first to tell you the words I'm sure you've longed to hear. Jacob Barber, you are a free man." There was a cheer, and Jacob and I hugged. The judge banged his gavel, but he did so with an indulgent smile. When the courtroom was relatively quiet again, he gestured to the clerk, who read in a monotone. Apparently only she was not happy for the result. "Jacob Michael Barber, in the matter of indictment number 08-4407, the Commonwealth having nolle prosequi the within indictment, it is ordered by the court that you be discharged of this indictment and go without day insofar as this indictment is concerned. The bail previously posted may be returned to the surety. Case dismissed." Go without day. The awkward legal formulation that is the defendant's ticket out. It means you may go without any more court days scheduled. Go and not come back. Mary rubber-stamped the indictment, slipped the paper into her file, and tossed the file into her outbox with such bureaucratic efficiency that you might have thought she had a stack of cases to get through before lunch. And it was over. Or almost over. We made our way through the crowd of reporters, jostling now to congratulate us and get their video in time for the morning shows, and we wound up literally running down Thorndike Street to the garage where we were parked. Running, laughing, free. We made it to our car, and for an awkward moment we were preoccupied with trying to find the words to thank Jonathan, who graciously declined the credit because, he said, truthfully, he had not actually done anything. We thanked him anyway. Thanked him and thanked him. I pumped his arm up and down, and Lori hugged him. "You would have won," I told him, "I'm sure of it." In all of this, it was Jacob who saw them coming. "Uh-oh," he said. There were two of them. Dan Rifkin came first. He was wearing a tan trench coat, fancier than most, over-designed, with a profusion of buttons, pockets, and epaulettes. He still had that doll-like immobile face, so it was impossible to know exactly what he intended. Apologizing to us, perhaps? A few feet behind him was Father O'Leary, a giant by comparison with Rifkin, ambling along with his hands in his pockets and his scally cap pulled low over his eyes. We turned slowly to meet them. We must all have had the same expression, puzzled but pleased to see this man who should naturally have been our friend now, despite the pain he had been through, graciously coming to welcome us back into his world, into the real world. But his expression was strange, hard. Lori said, "Dan?" He did not respond. He took from one of the deep pockets of his trench coat a knife, an ordinary kitchen knife, which I recognized, absurd as this sounds, as a Wusthof classic steak knife, because we have the same set of knives in a knife block on our kitchen counter. But I did not have time to fully fathom the sublime weirdness of being stabbed with such a knife, because almost immediately, before Dan Rifkin got within a few feet of us, Father O'Leary grabbed Rifkin by the arm. He banged Rifkin's hand once on the hood of the car, which caused the knife to clatter down to the concrete garage floor. Then he flipped Rifkin's arm behind the little man's back and easily, so easily he might have been manipulating a mannequin, bent him over the hood of the car. He said to Rifkin, "Easy there, chump." He did all this with expert, graceful professionalism. The whole transaction could not have lasted more than a few seconds, and we were left gaping at the two men. "Who are you?" I said finally. "Friend of your father's. He asked me to look out for you." "My father? How do you know my father? No, wait, don't tell me. I don't want to know." "What do you want me to do with this guy?" "Let him go. What's wrong with you?" He did. Rifkin straightened himself up. He had tears in his eyes. He looked at us with helpless impotence. Apparently, he still believed Jacob had killed his son, but he could not do anything about it. And he staggered off to what torments I cannot imagine. Father O'Leary went to Jacob and extended his hand. "Congratulations, kid. That was something in there this morning. Did you see the expression on that asshole DA's face? Priceless." Jacob shook his hand with a bewildered expression. "Hell of a show," Father O'Leary said. "Hell of a show." He laughed. "And you're Billy Barber's kid." "Yeah." I had never been proud to say that. I'm not sure I had ever actually said it out loud in public before. But it gave me a connection to Father O'Leary, and it seemed to amuse him, so we both smiled at it. "You're bigger than him, that's for sure. You could fit two of that little shit inside of you." I did not know what to do with that comment, so I just stood there. "Tell your old man I said hello, all right," Father O'Leary said. "Jesus, I could tell you stories about him." "Don't, please." Finally, to Jacob, "It's your lucky day, kid." He laughed again and ambled away, and I've never seen Father O'Leary again to this day. Part 4. Precisely how the electrical signals and chemical reactions occurring second by second in the human body make the leap to thought, motivation, impulse, where the physical machinery of man stops and the ghost in the machine, consciousness, begins, is not truly a scientific question, for the simple reason that we cannot design an experiment to capture, measure, or duplicate it. For all we have learned, the fact remains that we do not understand in any meaningful way why people do what they do, and likely never will. Paul Heitz, Neurocriminology and Its Discontents, American Journal of Criminology and Public Policy, Fall 2008. Chapter 37. Afterlife. Life goes on, probably too long if we're being honest about it. In a long life, there are 30 or 35,000 days to be got through, but only a few dozen that really matter. Big days when something momentous happens. The rest, the vast majority, tens of thousands of days, are unremarkable, repetitive, even monotonous. We glide through them, then instantly forget them. We tend not to think about this arithmetic when we look back on our lives. We remember the handful of big days and throw away the rest. We organize our long, shapeless lives into tidy little stories, as I am doing here. But our lives are mostly made up of junk, of ordinary, forgettable days. And the end is never the end. The day Jacob was exonerated, of course, was a big day. But after it, remarkably, the little days just kept on coming. We did not return to normal. We had, all three of us, forgotten what normal was. At least we had no illusions that we would ever get back to it. But in the days and weeks after Jacob's release, as the euphoria of our vindication receded, we did fall into a routine, if a barren one. We went out very little, never to restaurants or other public places where we felt leered at. I took over the grocery shopping since Lori would not risk running into the Rifkins at the market again, and I picked up the wifely habit of planning the week's dinner menus in my head as I shopped. Pasta Monday, chicken Tuesday, hamburgers Wednesday. We went to a few movies, usually midweek when the theaters were less crowded, and even then we made a point of slipping in just as the lights went down. Mostly, we loafed around the house, We surfed the web incessantly, entranced, glassy-eyed. We exercised on the treadmill in the basement rather than jog outside. We upped our Netflix plans so that we had as many DVDs on hand as possible. It sounds dismal looking back on it, but at the time it felt wonderful. We were free, or something like it. We considered moving, not to Buenos Aires, alas, but to more prosaic places where we might start again. Florida, California, Wyoming, anywhere we imagined people went to reinvent themselves. For a while I was preoccupied with the little town of Bisbee, Arizona, where I was told it is easy to get lost and stay lost. There was always the possibility of leaving the country, too, which had a certain glamour. We got into interminable discussions about all this. Lori doubted we could outrun the publicity the case had received, no matter how far we moved. Anyway, she said her whole life was in Boston. For my part, I was eager to move somewhere else. I did not belong to any place to begin with. My home was wherever Lori was. But I never was able to make much headway with her. In Newton, bad feelings lingered. Most of our neighbors had reached their own verdict. Not guilty, but not exactly innocent either. Jacob may not have murdered Ben Rifkin, but they had heard enough to be disturbed by him. His knife, his violent fantasies, his wicked bloodline. To some, the abrupt end of the trial seemed fishy, too. The kid's continued presence in town worried and irritated people. Even the kind ones were not anxious to have Jacob in their children's lives. Why take a chance? Even if they were 99% sure of his innocence, who would risk being wrong when the stakes were so high? And who would risk the stigma of being seen with him? He was a pariah, whether he was actually guilty or not. With all this, we did not dare send Jacob back to school in Newton. When he had first been indicted and promptly suspended from school, the town had been obliged to hire a home tutor for him, Mrs. McGowan. And we rehired her now to continue homeschooling him. Mrs. McGowan was the only regular visitor to our house, virtually the only one who ever saw the way we actually lived. When she walked in, a bit dowdy and heavy-hipped, her eyes would dance around, taking in the piles of dirty laundry, the unwashed dishes in the kitchen sink, Jacob's dirty hair. We must have seemed a little crazy to her, but she continued to show up every morning at 9 to sit with Jacob at the kitchen table, reviewing his lessons, drubbing him for not doing his homework. "No one's going to feel sorry for you," she told him forthrightly. Lori took an active part in Jacob's lessons, too. She was a remarkable teacher, I thought, patient, kind. I had never actually seen her teach before, but watching her work with Jacob, I thought, she should go back to teaching. She should have been doing it all along. As the weeks went by, Jacob was quite content in his new solitary life. He was a natural hermit. He did not miss school or his friends, he said. In fact, homeschooling might have suited him best from the start. It gave him the best part of school, the content, his word, without the myriad complications of girls, sex, sports, bullies, peer pressure, cliques, the complication of other kids, basically. Jake was just happier alone. After what he'd been through, who could blame him? When we discussed moving, it was always Jacob who was most enthusiastically in favor. The farther, the remoter, the better. Bisbee, Arizona would suit him fine, he thought. That was Jacob, that equanimity, that poise, half serene, half oblivious. It will sound weird, I know, but Jacob, who always had the most at stake in this case, never broke down and cried, never lost it. Sometimes he would get angry or sullen or introverted, occasionally self-pitying, as all kids do, but he never came apart. Now that the case was over, he was that same even-tempered kid. It was not hard to imagine why his classmates might find his eerie composure a little off-putting. Personally, I found it admirable. I did not have to work, at least for a while. I was still technically on paid leave from the district attorney's office. My full salary continued to be direct deposited to my checking account, as it had been throughout this entire episode. No doubt this was a tricky problem for Lynn Canavan. She had backed the wrong horse. Now she had no excuse to fire me since I had done nothing wrong, but she could not very well bring me back as first assistant either. Eventually she would have to offer me a position, and I would have to refuse it, and that would be the end of it. But in the near term she seemed willing to keep me on the payroll in return for my keeping my mouth shut, which seemed like a small price to pay. I would have kept my mouth shut anyway. I liked her.
Meanwhile, Canavan had bigger fish to fry. She had to figure out what to do about LeJudas, the Rasputin in her court, whose professional implosion had surely ended his own political hopes and, if she was not careful, might end hers too. But again, she could not fire a prosecutor merely for losing a case. Otherwise, who would ever be willing to work for her? The general view was that Canavan would run for attorney general or even governor soon and leave the whole mess behind for the next DA to clean up. But for the time being, all she could do was watch and wait. Maybe LeJudas would resurrect his reputation somehow. Hey, you never know. I did not worry much about my own career for the time being. Certainly I was done as a prosecutor. The snickering would have been too much. I suppose I might have gone on as some other kind of lawyer. There was always criminal defense, where the link to Jacob's case might even have been a badge of honor. The drama of an innocent boy wrongly accused who had stood up to the man or whatever. But it was a little late in the day to be switching sides. I was not sure I could bring myself to defend the same scumbags I had spent a lifetime locking up. Where that left me, I had no idea. In limbo, I suppose, like the rest of my family. Of the three of us, Lori was the most beaten up by the trial. In the weeks that followed, she did recover a little, but she never did return to what she was before. She never put back on the weight she had lost, and her face would always look drawn to me. It was as if she'd aged 10 years in just a few months. But the real change was inside. In those first weeks after Jacob's trouble, there was a cool, guarded quality about Lori. She was wary. To me, this new, more cautious manner was understandable. She had been victimized, and she responded the way victims do. It did alter the dynamics of our family. No more Mom warmly imploring Jacob and me, the family involutes, to share our feelings and jabber about our problems and generally turn ourselves inside out for her. She had withdrawn from all that, for a while at least. She watched us from a distance now. I could hardly begrudge her any of this. Damaged at last, my wife had become a little like me, a little harder. Damage hardens us all. It will harden you, too, when it finds you. And it will find you. Chapter 38. The Policeman's Dilemma. Northern Correctional Institution, Summers, Connecticut. In the visiting booth again, sealed up in my white-walled compartment, thick glass window in front of me, steady background noise, murmuring in the adjacent booths, in the distance, muted shouts and prison racket, announcements over an intercom. Bloody Billy shuffled into the window frame, his hands cuffed to a waist chain, a second chain running from his waist down to his cuffed ankles. No matter, he came into the room like a tyrannical king, chin thrust forward, badass sneer, gray hair combed back over his head in a crazy old man pompadour. Two guards piloted him to the chair, but without laying a hand on him. One of them released the handcuffs from his waist while the other watched, then they both backed away out of the window frame. My father picked up the phone and, with his hands joined at his chin as if in prayer, he said, "Junior!" His tone said, "What a pleasant surprise." "Why did you do it?" "Do what?" "Pats." His eyes traveled from my face to the phone on the wall and back, reminding me to watch what I said on a monitored line. "Junior, what are you talking about? I've been here the whole time. Maybe you haven't heard. I don't get out much." I unfolded a triple-I record, a multi-state criminal record. It was several pages long. I palmed it smooth and pressed the front page against the glass with 5 fingertips for him to read the name. James Michael O'Leary, a.k.a. Jimmy, Jimmy O, Father O'Leary, D.O.B., 2-18-43. He leaned forward and squinted at the document. "Never heard of him." "Never heard of him, really." "Never heard of him." "You did a bid with him right here." "A lot of guys come through here." 6 years you were here together, 6 years. He shrugged. "I don't socialize. It's jail, not Yale. Maybe if you had a picture or something?" Mischievous wink. "But I never heard of this guy." "Well, he's heard of you." Shrug. "Lots of people have heard of me. I'm a legend." He said you asked him to look out for us, to look out for Jacob. Bullshit. To protect us. Bullshit. You sent someone to protect us? You think I need you to protect my kid? Hey, I never said any of that. This is all you talking. Like I said, I never heard of this guy. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. Now, spend enough time in a courthouse and you become a connoisseur of lying. You learn to recognize the various types of bullshit, as Eskimos are said to distinguish different types of snow. The sort of winking denial Billy was indulging here, in which the words, "I didn't do it," were delivered in a way that announced, "Of course I did it, but we both know you can't prove it," must be every criminal's special delight. To laugh in a cop's face. Certainly my dirtbag father was enjoying the hell out of it. From the cop's point of view, there is no sense fighting this sort of confession denial. You learn to accept this situation. It is part of the game. It is the policeman's dilemma. Sometimes you can't prove the case without a confession, but you can't get a confession unless you already have proof. So I just took the paper down from the glass and dropped it on the little melamine counter in front of me. I sat back and rubbed my forehead. You fool. You stupid old fool. Do you know what you've done? Fool? What are you calling me a fool? I didn't do shit. Jacob was innocent. You stupid, stupid old man. Watch your mouth, Junior. I don't have to stay here talking to you. We didn't need your help. No, could have fooled me. We would have won. And if you didn't, what then? You want the kid to rot in a place like this? You know what this place is, Junior? This is a grave. It's a garbage dump. It's a big hole in the ground where they throw the trash nobody wants to see anymore. Anyways, you're the one who told me that night on the phone you were going to lose. Look, you can't just... Jesus, Junior, keep your dress on, would you? This is fucking embarrassing. Look, I'm not saying anything about what happened, okay, 'cause I don't know. Whatever happened to this guy, what's his name, Pats? Whatever happened to this guy, I don't know. I'm stuck here in this pit. What the hell do I know? But if you're asking me to boo-hoo because some kitty raper child molester piece of shit got killed or killed himself or whatever, forget about it. Good riddance. One less piece of shit in the world. Fuck him. He's gone. He held a fist to his mouth and blew into it, then blossomed open his fingers like a magician making a coin disappear. Gone. One less asshole in the world, that's all it is. Guy like that, the world's a better place without him. But with you? He glared. Hey, I'm still here. He puffed his chest. It don't matter what you think of me, I'm still here, Junior, whether you like it or not. You can't get rid of me. Like cockroaches. That's right, I'm a tough old cockroach. Proud of it. So what did you do? Call in a favor? Or just reach out to an old friend? I told you I don't know what you're talking about. You know, the thing is, it actually took me a while to figure it out. I've got a cop friend who told me this guy Father O'Leary was an old leg breaker and he was still working as a fixer. And when I asked what that meant, a fixer, he said, he makes problems go away. So that's what you did, isn't it? You called an old friend and you made the problem go away. No answer. Why should he help me by talking? Bloody Billy understood the policeman's dilemma as well as I did. No confession, no case. No case, no confession. But we both knew what went down. We were thinking the exact same thing, I'm sure. Father O'Leary goes over there one night after a particularly bad day for Jacob in court, and he puts a scare into this fat kid, waves a gun in his face, makes him sign a confession. The kid probably shit his pants before Father O'Leary strung him up. Do you know what you've done to Jacob? Yeah, I saved his life. No. You took away his day in court. You took away his chance to hear the jury say, not guilty. From now on, there'll always be a little doubt. There'll always be people convinced Jacob is a murderer. He laughed. Not a little laugh, but a roar. Ha! His day in court, and I'm the fool? Junior, you know what? You're not as smart as I thought you were. He laughed some more. Big, crazy, gusting belly laughs. He mimicked me in a high, prissy voice.
Oh, his day in court.
Ha ha, Jesus, Junior. It's a wonder you're out there and I'm in here. How the fuck does that happen, you dumb gavoon? It's a crazy world. Imagine them putting a guy like you in prison. He ignored me. He leaned forward as if he meant to whisper a secret in my ear through the inch-thick slab of glass. Listen, he confided. You want to get all Dudley Do Right here? You want to throw your kid back in the shit? Is that what you want, Junior? Call the cops. Go ahead. Call the cops and tell them this whole crazy story you've got about Pats and this guy O'Leary I supposedly know. What do I give a shit? I'm in here for life anyway. You won't be hurting me. Go on. He's your kid. Do what you want with him. Like you said, maybe the kid'll get off. Take your chances. They can't try Jacob again anyway. Jeopardy's attached. So, even better. Sounds like you think this guy O'Leary committed a murder. If I was you, I'd go report it right away. Is that what you're going to do, Mr. D.A. man? Or maybe that won't look so good for the kid, will it? He looked me square in the eyes for a few seconds until I became aware of my own blinking. No, he said, I didn't think so. We through here? Yeah, good. Hey, guard! Guard! Two guards ambled over with skeptical faces. Me and my son are all done visiting. You guys ever met my son? The guards did not answer, did not even glance at me. They seemed to think it was a trick to get them to look away for a second, and they were not about to fall for it. Their job was to get the wild animal back into its cage. That was dangerous enough. There was no percentage in breaking protocol. All right, my father said as one of the guards fished around for the key to reattach the cuffs to his harness. You come back soon, Junior. Remember, I'm still your father. I'll always be your father. The guards began to rustle him out of the chair, but he went right on talking. Hey, he said to the guards, you should get to know this guy. He's a lawyer. Maybe you guys will need a lawyer someday. One of the guards pulled the phone from his hand and hung it up. He stood the prisoner up, reattached the handcuffs to his waist chain, then tugged the whole arrangement of chains to make sure he was properly trussed. Billy's eyes were on me the whole time, even as the guards jostled him. What he saw when he looked at me is anybody's guess. Probably just a stranger in a window frame. Mr. LeJudas, I'm going to ask you again, and I'm going to remind you, Mr. Barber, you are under oath. Witness, I'm aware of that. Mr. LeJudas, and you are aware we are talking about a murder here. Witness, the ME ruled it a suicide. Mr. LeJudas, Leonard Pats was murdered and you know it. Witness, I don't know how anyone could know that. Mr. LeJudas, and you have nothing to add? Witness, no. Mr. LeJudas, you have no idea what happened to Leonard Pats on October 25th, 2007? Witness, none. Mr. LeJudas, any theories? Witness, none. Mr. LeJudas, do you know anything at all about James Michael O'Leary, also known as Father O'Leary? Witness, never heard of him. Mr. LeJudas, really, you've never even heard the name? Witness, never heard of him. I remember Neil LeJudas standing there with his arms crossed, smoldering. Once upon a time, I might have patted him on the back, told him, witnesses lie, nothing you can do. Go have a beer, just let it go. All crime is local, Neil. These guys all come back sooner or later. But LeJudas was not the type to shrug off an insolent witness. Probably he did not give a shit about the Pats murder anyway. This was not about Leonard Pats. It was already late afternoon when LeJudas finally forced me into a little harmless perjury. I'd been testifying all day and I was tired. It was April. The days were beginning to get longer. The daylight was just beginning to dim when I said, never heard of him. By then, LeJudas must have known he was not going to restore his own reputation here, least of all by asking for my help.
He resigned from the DA's office soon after. He is a defense lawyer in Boston now. I have no doubt he will make a great defense lawyer, too, right up until the day he is disbarred. But for now, I console myself with that image of him in the grand jury room doing a slow burn as his case and his career collapsed before his eyes. I like to think of it as the last lesson I ever taught him, my former protege. It is the policeman's dilemma, Neil. After a while, you get used to it. Chapter 39. Paradise. It turns out you can get used to most anything. What one day seems a shocking, unbearable outrage over time comes to seem ordinary, unremarkable. As those first few months passed, the insult of Jacob's trial gradually lost its power to enrage us. We had done all we could. This grotesque thing had happened to our family. We would always be known for it. It would be the first sentence in all our obituaries. And we would always be shaped by the experience in ways we could not guess at the time. All this began to seem normal, permanent, hardly worth commenting on. And when it did, when we started to get used to our new life as a notorious family, when we finally began to look forward, not back, our family gradually reemerged. Lori was the first of us to reawaken. She renewed her friendship with Toby Lanceman. Toby had not reached out to us during the trial, but she was one of the first of our Newton friends to reconnect with us afterward. Still her old, fit, commanding self, same lean runner's face, same springy, high-rumped body. Toby guided Lori in a fearsome exercise program that included long, cold jogs along Commonwealth Avenue. Lori wanted to get stronger, she said. Soon, Lori was driving herself through grueling workouts even without Toby. She would come back from increasingly long runs, red-faced and glistening with sweat in the dead of winter. Have to get stronger. Recovering her role as family captain, Lori threw herself into the great project of reviving Jacob and me as well. She cooked tremendous breakfasts of waffles or omelets or hot cereal. And now that we had no jobs to rush off to, we lingered over the newspapers, which Jacob read on his MacBook, while Lori and I shared the newsprint versions of the Globe and the Times. She organized family movie nights and even allowed me to pick the gangster pictures I love. Then she suffered good-naturedly as Jacob and I repeated our favorite lines over and over.
"Say hello to my little friend!"
And "I didn't know until this day that it was Barzini all along."
She said that my Brando sounded like Elmer Fudd, which required a trip to YouTube to show Jacob who Elmer Fudd was. How strange to hear ourselves laughing again. And when all this was not working fast enough, when Jacob and I could not seem to shake the gloom of the last year, Lori decided that stronger medicine was needed. "Why don't we go away for a while?" she said brightly at dinner one night. "We could take a family vacation like we used to." It was one of those blindingly obvious ideas that hits you like a revelation. Of course. The moment she suggested it, we knew that of course we had to go. Why had it taken us so long to think of it? Just talking about the idea made us a little giddy. "That's brilliant," I said. "Clear our heads." "Push the reset button," Jacob said. Lori raised her fists and wiggled them. She was so excited. "I am so sick of all this. I hate this house. I hate this town. I hate the way I feel all day, trapped. I just really want to be someplace else." My memory is that the three of us went right to the computer and chose our destination that same night. We picked a resort in Jamaica called Waves. None of us had ever heard of Waves or been to Jamaica. We based the decision on nothing more than the resort's own website, which dazzled us with fantastically photoshopped images. Palm trees, white sand beaches, aquamarine ocean. It was all so perfect and so obviously fraudulent that we could not resist it. It was travel porn. There were laughing couples, she toned and tan in her bikini and wrap, he gray at the temples but sporting a full rack of bodybuilder's abs. The soccer mom and middle manager transformed at Waves into their true inner minx and stud. There was a hotel complex festooned with shutters and verandas, the exteriors brightly painted to evoke a fantasy Caribbean village. The hotel overlooked a network of cerulean swimming pools with fountains and swim-up bars. The Waves logo shimmered on every pool floor. The blue pools spilled from one down to the next until the water reached the edge of a low cliff, and over the edge an elevator descended to a horseshoe-shaped beach and a pristine little quay, and off in the distance the blue of the ocean stretched all the way out into the endless blue of the sky with no clear horizon line, which would have spoiled the illusion that Waves inhabited the same round planet as every place else. It was just the sort of dream world we longed to escape into. We did not want to go any place real. You cannot be in a place like Paris or Rome without thinking, and we wanted most of all not to think. At Waves, happily, it seemed no thought could survive for long. Nothing would be allowed to spoil the fun. The remarkable thing about all this emotional manipulation was that it actually worked. We actually achieved the traveler's fantasy of leaving our old selves and all our troubles behind. We were transported in both senses. Not all at once, of course, but little by little. We felt the weight begin to lift the moment we booked the trip, a nice long 2-week stay. Then we felt lighter still when the plane lifted off from Boston, and even more so when we stepped out into the glare and the warm tropical breeze on the tarmac at the little airport in Montego Bay. Already we were different. We were strangely, miraculously, deliriously happy. We looked at one another with surprise, as if to say, could this be true? Are we really happy? You will say that we were deluding ourselves. Our troubles were no less real. And of course that is true, but so what? We had earned a vacation. At the airport, Jacob grinned. Lori held my hand. It's paradise, she beamed. We made our way through the terminal and out to a small shuttle bus, where a driver held a clipboard with the Waves logo and a list of guests he was supposed to pick up. He looked a little bedraggled in a t-shirt, shorts, and shower sandals. But he grinned at us and he peppered his sentences with, "Ya man!" And generally he made a good show of it. "Ya man!" he said over and over until we were saying it too. Obviously he had performed this happy native routine 1,000 times. The pasty vacationers ate it up, us included. "Ya man!" The bus ride lasted nearly 2 hours. We bounced over a crumbling road that roughly followed the north coast of the island. To our right were lush green mountains, to the left, the sea. The poverty of the island was hard to miss. We passed little tumble-down houses and shanties knocked together from scrap wood and corrugated tin. Ragged women and scrawny kids walked along the sides of the road. The vacationers in the bus were subdued during the ride. The natives' poverty was a bummer, and they wanted to be sensitive to it. At the same time, they had come for a good time, and it wasn't their fault the island was poor. Jacob found himself seated on the wide bench at the back of the bus next to a girl about his age. She was pretty in a debate team way, and the two kids chatted cautiously. Jacob kept his answers short, as if every word was a stick of dynamite. He wore a dumb grin. Here was a girl who did not know anything about the murder, did not even seem aware that Jacob was a geek who could not quite bring himself to look a girl in the eye. He was proving himself quite capable of looking this girl in the chest, however. It was also wonderfully normal. Lori and I made a point of not staring lest we screw it up for him. I whispered, "And I figured I'd get laid on this trip before Jacob." "My money's still on you," she said. When the bus finally arrived at Waves, we passed through a grand gate, past lush manicured beds of red hibiscus and yellow impatience, and stopped under a portico at the main entrance to the hotel. Grinning bellmen unpacked the bags. They wore uniforms that combined British military bits, pith helmets blankoed to a dazzling whiteness, black pants with a thick red stripe down the side, and bright flower-print shirts. It was a delirious combination, just right for the Army of Paradise, the Good Time Army. In the lobby, we checked in. We exchanged our money for the in-house currency of Waves, little silver coins called sand dollars. A good time soldier in a pith helmet served a complimentary rum punch, about which I can tell you only that it contained grenadine, it was bright red, and rum, and I immediately had another, feeling it was my patriotic duty to the pseudonation of Waves.
I tipped the soldier. Lord knew how much, since the exchange rate for sand dollars was a nebulous thing, but the tip must have been generous because he pocketed the coin and said, "Yaman," illogically but happily. From there, my memory of the first day gets a little fuzzy. And the second. I apologize for the silly tone, but the truth is we were damn happy and relieved. With the strain of the previous year finally removed, we got a little silly. I know this story is all a very solemn business. Ben Rifkin had still been murdered, even if it had not been by Jacob. And Jacob had only been saved by the intervention of a second murder arranged by a Deus Ex prison, a secret only I was aware of. And of course, as the accused, we were still widely presumed guilty of something, and so we had no right to be happy anyway. We had taken to heart Jonathan's very strict instructions, never to laugh or smile in public, lest anyone think we were not treating the situation with the proper gravity, lest they think we were anything less than shattered. Now, finally, we exhaled, and in our exhaustion we felt intoxicated even when we weren't. We did not feel like murderers at all. We spent our first few mornings at the beach, afternoons at one of the many pools. Every evening the resort offered some sort of entertainment. This might be a musical show or karaoke or a talent contest for the guests. Whatever the format, the staff exhorted us to have the most extroverted sort of fun. They would call from the stage in lilting island accents, "Come on, everybody, make some noise!" And we guests would clap and cheer with maximum gusto. Afterward, there would be dancing. A good dose of Waves punch was required to get through it. We ate ravenously. Meals were all-you-can-eat buffets, and we made up for months of undereating. Laurie and I spent our sand dollars on beers and piña coladas. Jacob even tried his first beer. "Good," he pronounced it manfully, though he did not finish it. Jacob spent most of his time with his new girlfriend, whose name, brace yourself, was Hope. He was content to be with us too, but more and more the two of them went off together. Later we found out that Jacob had given her a false last name. Jacob Gold, he called himself, borrowing Lori's maiden name, which is why Hope never found out about the case. We did not know about Jacob's little subterfuge at the time, so we were left to wonder what it meant exactly that this girl was flirting with Jacob. Was she so oblivious that it never occurred to her to do a simple Google search on him? If she had Googled Jacob Barber, she would have come up with about 300,000 results. The number has grown since then. Or maybe she did know and got some weird thrill out of dating this dangerous pariah. Jacob told us Hope had no idea about the case, and we did not dare question her directly for fear of spoiling the first good thing that had happened to Jacob in a very long time. We did not see much of Hope anyway in the few days we knew her. She and Jake preferred to be by themselves. Even if we were all at the pool together, the two of them would come over to say hello, then they would go sit at a little distance from us. Once we glimpsed them holding hands furtively as they lay on adjacent chaises. I want to say, it is important you know, we liked Hope, not least because she made our son happy. Jacob brightened whenever she was around. She had a warm way about her. She was courteous and polite, with blonde hair and a wonderful soft Virginia accent that seemed lovely to us Bostonians. She was a little pudgy but comfortable in her body, comfortable enough to wear bikinis every day. And we liked her for that, too, for the easy way she carried herself, free of the usual morbid teenage insecurities. Even her unlikely name added to the fairy tale symmetry of her sudden appearance on stage. "Finally, we have Hope," I would say to Lori. The truth is, we were not entirely focused on Jacob and Hope. Lori and I had our own relationship to work on. We had to relearn each other, reestablish the old patterns. We even resumed our sex life, not frantically, but slowly, tentatively. Probably we were as clumsy as Jacob and Hope, who no doubt were fumbling over each other at the same time in secret corners and thrust up against palm trees. Lori got very brown very quickly, as she always has. To my middle-aged eyes, she looked insanely sexy, and I began to wonder if the website did not have it right after all. She looked more and more like the hot soccer mom in the ad. She was still the best-looking woman I ever saw. It was a miracle that I got her in the first place, and a miracle that she stayed with me as long as she did.
I think that sometime in that first week, Lori began to forgive herself for the primal sin, as she saw it, of losing faith in her own son, of doubting his innocence during the trial. You could see it in the way she began to loosen up around him. This was an internal struggle for her. She had nothing to reconcile with Jacob, since he never knew about her doubts, let alone that she had actually been afraid of him. Only Lori could forgive herself. Personally, I did not see it as such a big deal. As betrayals go, this was a small one and understandable in the circumstances. Maybe you have to be a mother to know why she took it so hard. All I can say is that as Lori began to feel better, our whole family began to return to its normal rhythm. Our family orbited around Lori. Always had. We quickly settled into a few routines, as people must, even in dream worlds like waves. My favorite ritual was to watch the sunset from the beach as a family. Every evening, we brought beers down with us and dragged 3 beach chairs to the water's edge so we could sit with our feet in the water. Hope joined us to watch the sunset once, seating herself tactfully beside Lori like a lady-in-waiting attending her queen. But generally, it was just us 3 barbers. Around us in the dimming light, little children would play in the sand and the shallow water, toddlers, even a few babies and their young parents. Gradually, the beach would get quieter as the other guests left to get ready for dinner. The lifeguards would drag the empty beach chairs across the sand and stack them for the night, making a clatter. And finally, the lifeguards themselves would leave, and only a few sunset gazers would linger on the beach. We would look out into the distance, where 2 arms of land reached out to encircle the little bay, and the horizon would burn yellow, then red, then indigo. Looking back on it now, I picture my happy family of 3 sitting on that beach at sunset, and I want to freeze the story there. We must have looked so normal, Lori and Jacob and me, so much like all the other partiers and suburbanites at that resort. We must have seemed just like everyone else, which, when you get down to it, is all I ever really wanted. Mr. LeJudas. And then? Witness. And then? Mr. LeJudas. Then what happened, Mr. Barber? Witness. The girl disappeared. Chapter 40. No way out. Evening was coming on now. Outside, daylight was withdrawing, the sky going dull, the familiar sunless gray sky of a cold spring in New England. The grand jury room, no longer flooded with clear sunlight, went yellow under the fluorescent lights. The jurors' attention had come and gone the last few hours, but now they sat up attentively. They knew what was coming. I had been in the chair testifying all day. I must have looked a little haggard. LeJudas circled me excitedly, like a boxer sizing up a woozy opponent. Mr. LeJudas, do you have any information about what happened to Hope Connors? Witness, no. Mr. LeJudas, when did you learn she had vanished? Witness, I don't recall exactly. I remember how it began. We got a call in our room at the resort around dinner time. It was Hope's mother asking if she was with Jacob. They had not heard from her all afternoon. Mr. LeJudas, what did you tell her? Witness, that we hadn't seen her. Mr. LeJudas, and Jacob, what did he say about it? Witness, Jake was with us. I asked him if he knew where Hope was. He said no. Mr. LeJudas, was there anything unusual about Jacob's reaction when you asked him that question? Witness, no, he just shrugged. There was no reason to worry. We all figured she'd probably just gone off to explore. Probably she lost track of time. There was no cell phone reception there, so the kids were constantly disappearing. But the resort was very safe. It was completely fenced in. No one could get in to harm her. Hope's mom wasn't panicked either. I told her not to worry. Hope would probably be back any minute. Mr. LeJudas. But Hope Connors never did come back. Witness. No. Mr. LeJudas. In fact, her body was not found for several weeks, isn't that right? Witness. 7 weeks. Mr. LeJudas. And when it was found? Witness. The body was washed up on the shore several miles away from the resort. She drowned, apparently. Mr. LeJudas. Apparently? Witness. When a body is in the water that long, It had deteriorated. My understanding is that it had also been fed on by marine life. I don't know for certain. I was not privy to that investigation. Suffice it to say, the body did not yield much evidence. Mr. LeJudas, the case is considered an unsolved homicide? Witness, I don't know. It shouldn't be. There's no evidence to support that. The evidence suggests only that she went swimming and drowned. Mr. LeJudas, well, that's not quite true, is it? There is some evidence that Hope Connors' windpipe was crushed before she went into the water. Witness, that inference is not supported by the evidence. The body was badly degraded. The cops down there, there was so much pressure, so much media, that investigation was not conducted properly. Mr. LeJudas, that happened quite a bit around Jacob, didn't it? A murder, a botched investigation? He must have been the unluckiest boy. Witness, is that a question? Mr. LeJudas, we'll move on. Your son's name has been widely linked to the case, hasn't it? Witness, in the tabloids and some sleazy websites. They'll say anything for money. There's no profit in saying Jacob was innocent. Mr. LeJudas, how did Jacob react to the girl's disappearance? Witness, he was concerned, of course. Hope was someone he cared about. Mr. LeJudas, and your wife? Witness, she was also very, very concerned. Mr. LeJudas, that's all? Very, very concerned? Witness, yes. Mr. LeJudas, isn't it fair to say she concluded Jacob had something to do with that girl's disappearance? Witness, yes. Mr. LeJudas, was there anything in particular that convinced her of this? Witness, there was something that happened at the beach. It was the day the girl disappeared. Jacob got there, this was late afternoon, to watch the sunset. And he sat on my right. Lori was on my left. We said, where's Hope? Jacob said, with her family, I guess. I haven't seen her. So we made some kind of joke. I think it was Lori who asked if everything was all right between them, if they'd had a fight. He said no, he just hadn't seen her for a few hours. Mr. LeJudas. Andy, are you all right? Witness. Yeah, sorry, yes. Jake, he had these spots on his bathing suit, these little red spots. Mr. LeJudas. Describe the spots. Witness. They were spatters. Mr. LeJudas. What color? Witness. Brownish red. Mr. LeJudas. Blood spatters? Witness. I don't know. I don't think so. I asked him what it was. What did he do to his bathing suit? He said he must have dripped something he'd been eating, ketchup or something. Mr. LeJudas. And your wife? What did she think of the red spatters? Witness. She didn't think anything at the time. It was nothing, because we didn't know the girl was missing yet. I told him to just go jump in the water and swim around until the bathing suit was clean. Mr. LeJudas. How did Jacob react? Witness. He didn't react at all. He just got up and he walked out on the dock. It was an H-shaped dock. He walked out the right-hand dock, and he dove in. Mr. LeJudas. Interesting that it was you who told him to wash the bloodstains off his bathing suit. Witness. I had no idea if they were bloodstains. I still don't know if that's true. Mr. LeJudas. You still don't know? Really? Then why were you so quick to tell him to jump in the water? Witness. Lori said something to him about how the bathing suit was expensive and Jacob should take better care of his things. He was so careless, such a slob. I didn't want him to get in trouble with his mother. We were all having such a good time, that's all it was. Mr. LeJudas. But this was why Lori was upset when Hope Connors first went missing? Witness. Partly, yes, it was the whole situation, everything we'd been through. Mr. LeJudas. Lori wanted to go home immediately, isn't that right? Witness. Yes. Mr. LeJudas. But you refused. Witness. Yes. Mr. LeJudas. Why? Witness. Because I knew what people would say, that Jacob was guilty and he was running away before the cops could pick him up. They would call him a killer. I wasn't going to let anyone say that about him. Mr. LeJudas. In fact, the authorities in Jamaica did question Jacob, didn't they? Witness. Yes. Mr. LeJudas. But they never arrested him.
Witness, no, there was no reason to arrest him. He didn't do anything. Mr. LeJudas, Jesus, Andy, how can you be so damn sure? How can you be sure of that? Witness, how can anyone be sure of anything? I trust my kid. I have to. Mr. LeJudas, you have to? Why? Witness, because I'm his father. I owe him that. Mr. LeJudas, that's it? Witness, yes. Mr. LeJudas, what about Hope Connors? What did you owe her? Witness, Jacob did not kill that girl. Mr. LeJudas, kids just kept dying around him, is that it? Witness, that's an improper question. Mr. LeJudas, I'll withdraw it. Andy, do you honestly think you're a reliable witness? Do you honestly think you see your son right? Witness, I think I'm reliable, yes, generally. I don't think any parent can be completely objective about his kid, I'll concede that. Mr. LeJudas, and yet Lori had no trouble seeing Jacob for what he was, did she? Witness, you'll have to ask her. Mr. LeJudas, Lori had no trouble believing Jacob had something to do with that girl's vanishing. Witness, as I said, Lori was very shaken by the whole thing. She was not herself. She came to her own conclusions. Mr. LeJudas, did she ever discuss her suspicions with you? Witness, no. Mr. LeJudas, I'll repeat the question. Did your wife ever discuss her suspicions about Jacob? Witness, no, she did not. Mr. LeJudas, your own wife never confided in you? Witness, she did not feel that she could. Not about this. We talked about the Rifkin case, of course. I think she knew there were some things I just could not discuss. There were some places I just could not go. Those things she would just have to handle by herself. Mr. LeJudas, so after 2 weeks in Jamaica? Witness, we came home. Mr. LeJudas, and when you got home, at that point, did Lori finally voice her suspicions about Jacob? Witness, not really. Mr. LeJudas, not really. What does that mean? Witness, when we got home from Jamaica, Lori was very, very quiet. She wouldn't discuss anything at all with me, really. She was very wary, very upset. She was scared. I tried to talk to her, draw her out, but she didn't trust me, I think. Mr. LeJudas, did she ever discuss what you two ought to do morally as parents? Witness, no. Mr. LeJudas, if she had asked you, what would you have said? What do you think your moral obligation was as parents of a murderer? Witness, it's a hypothetical question. I don't believe we were parents of a murderer. Mr. LeJudas, all right, hypothetically then, if Jacob was guilty, what should you and your wife have done about it? Witness, you can ask the question as many ways as you like, Neil. I won't answer it. It never happened. What happened then, I can honestly say, was the most genuine, spontaneous reaction I ever saw out of Neil LeJudas. He flung his yellow pad in frustration. It fluttered like a shotgunned bird tumbling out of the sky, settling in the far corner of the room. An older woman on the grand jury gasped. I thought for a moment it was one of LeJudas's phony gestures, a cue to the jury. Can't you see he's lying? The better, because it would not show up in the transcript. But LeJudas just stood there, hands on hips, looking at his shoes, faintly shaking his head. After a moment, he collected himself. He folded his arms and took a deep breath. Back to it. Lure, trap, fuck. He raised his eyes to me and saw, what? A criminal? A victim? In any event, a disappointment. I rather doubt he had the sense to see the truth, that there were wounds worse than fatal, which the law's little binary distinctions, guilty, innocent, criminal, victim, cannot fathom, let alone fix. The law is a hammer, not a scalpel. Mr. LeJudas, you understand this grand jury is investigating your wife, Lori Barber. Witness, of course. Mr. LeJudas, we've been here all day talking about her, about why she did this. Witness, yes. Mr. LeJudas, I don't give a damn about Jacob. Witness, if you say so. Mr. LeJudas, and you know that you're not under any suspicion of anything at all. Witness, if you say so. Mr. LeJudas, but you are under oath. I don't need to remind you of that. Witness, yes, I know the rules, Neil. Mr. LeJudas, what your wife did, Andy, I don't understand why you won't help us.
This was your family. Witness. Pose a question, Neil. Don't make speeches. Mr. LeJudas. What Lori did, doesn't it bother you? Witness. Objection. Pose a proper question. Mr. LeJudas. She should be indicted. Witness. Next question. Mr. LeJudas. She should be indicted and brought to trial and locked up, and you know it. Witness. Next question. Mr. LeJudas. On the date of offense, March 19th, 2008, did you receive news about the defendant, Lori Barber? Witness. Yes. Mr. LeJudas. How? Witness. Around 9 a.m., the doorbell rang. It was Paul Duffy. Mr. LeJudas. What did Lieutenant Duffy say? Witness. He asked if he could come inside and sit down. He said he had terrible news. I told him, just say it, whatever it was, just tell me right there at the door. He said there'd been an accident. Lori and Jacob were in the car, on the pike, and it went off the road. He said Jacob was dead. Lori was banged up pretty bad, but she would make it. Mr. LeJudas. Go on. The witness did not respond. Mr. LeJudas. What happened next, Mr. Barber? The witness did not respond. Mr. LeJudas. Andy? Witness. I felt my knees begin to buckle. I started to fall straight down. Paul reached out to grab me. He held me up. He helped me into the living room to a chair. Mr. LeJudas. What else did he tell you? Witness. He said... Mr. LeJudas. Do you need to take a break? Witness. No. Sorry, I'm all right. Mr. LeJudas. What else did Lieutenant Duffy tell you? Witness. He said there were no other cars involved. There were witnesses, other drivers, who saw the car aimed directly at a bridge abutment. She did not put on the brakes or try to steer away from it. The witnesses said she accelerated as she headed for the collision. She actually accelerated. The witnesses thought the driver must have passed out or had a heart attack or something. Mr. LeJudas. It was murder, Andy. She murdered your son. The witness did not respond. Mr. LeJudas. This grand jury wants to indict her. Look at them. They want to do the right thing. We all do. But you have to help us. You have to tell us the truth. What happened to your son? The witness did not respond. Mr. LeJudas. What happened to Jacob? The witness did not respond. Mr. LeJudas. This can still come out right, Andy. Witness. Can it? Outside the courthouse, a hard wind jetted down Thorndike Street. Another architectural flaw. The high flat walls on all four sides created a tornado wind around the base of the building. On a raw April evening like this, with the wind swirling around it, the courthouse could be hard even to reach. There might as well have been a moat around it. I pulled my coat around me and made my way down Thorndike toward the garage with the wind jostling my back. It was the last time I was ever in that courthouse. I leaned back against the wind like a man holding a door closed. Of course, some things are impossible to put behind you. I have imagined those last moments over and over. I relive the last few seconds of Jacob's life every day. And when I sleep, I dream of it. It does not matter that I was not there. I cannot keep my mind from seeing it. With less than 1 minute remaining in his life, Jacob lolled in the middle row of the minivan with his long legs stretched out in front of him. He always sat in the second row, like a little kid, even when he and his mom were the only ones in the car. He was not wearing his seatbelt. He was often careless about it. Ordinarily, Lori would have hassled him to put it on. That morning, she did not. Jacob and Lori had not spoken much during the ride. There was not much to say. Jacob's mom had been quiet and saturnine since we had come back from Jamaica a few weeks earlier. He was smart enough to give her some space. Deep down, he must have known he had lost his mother, lost her trust, not her love. It was hard for them to be together. So after exchanging a few labored words as they drove up Route 128, they both fell silent once they reached the turnpike, heading west off the ramp. The minivan merged into traffic and picked up speed, and mother and son settled in for the long, dull ride. There was another reason for Jacob's silence. He was going to an interview at a private school in Natick. We did not think any school would admit him, honestly. What school would risk the legal liability, even if it was willing to brave the notoriety of having bloody Jacob Barber on campus? We expected Jacob would be homeschooled for the rest of his high school years. But we had been instructed that the town would not cover the costs of homeschooling under a special ed plan unless we had exhausted all other options, so a few perfunctory interviews had been arranged. The whole process was difficult for Jacob. He had to prove he was not wanted by being rejected over and over. And this morning the need for another pointless interview made him sullen. The schools granted him interviews, he thought, just to get a glimpse of him, to see what the monster looked like up close. He asked his mom to turn on the radio. She put on WBUR, the NPR news station, but turned it off quickly. It was painful to be reminded that the great world continued to turn, unnoticing. After a few minutes on the highway, there were tears on Lori's face. She clenched the wheel. Jacob did not notice. He was lost in his own thoughts. His eyes were fixed on the view ahead of him between the two front seats, through the windshield, the crowd of cars speeding in formation down the track. Lori signaled and moved into the right lane where the traffic was sparse, and she began to pick up speed. 76, 77, 78, 79, 80. She unclipped her seatbelt and handed it back over her left shoulder. Jacob would have grown, of course. In a couple of years, his voice would have deepened. There would have been new friends. In his 20s, he would have looked more and more like his father. His dark stare would have relaxed with time into a gentler expression as he set down the worries and sorrows of adolescence. His raw-boned frame would have filled out. He would not have been as big as his hulking father, just a little taller, a little broader in the shoulders than most. He would have considered law school. All kids imagine themselves in their parents' occupations, however briefly, however uncomfortably. But he would not have become a lawyer. He would have considered the work too extroverted, too theatrical, too pedantic for his reticent personality. He would have spent a long time searching, a long time laboring in jobs that did not suit him. As the minivan crossed 85 miles per hour, Jacob said, without any real concern, "Going a little fast there, aren't you, Mom?" "Am I?" He would have met his grandfather. He was curious already, and given his own legal problems, he would have wanted to confront the whole issue of his patrimony, of what it meant to be the grandson of Bloody Billy Barber. He would have gone to meet the man and been disappointed. The legend, the nickname, the fearsome reputation, the murder that was literally unspeakable to so many, was much bigger than the withered old man behind it, who in the end was just a thug, albeit a well-bred thug. Jacob would have come to terms with it somehow. He would not have done it the way I did, by erasing it, ignoring it, willing it away. He was too thoughtful to fool himself that way. But he would have made his peace with it. He would have passed from son to father, and only then would he have seen how little the whole thing really meant. Later, after some wandering, he would have settled down far away, somewhere no one had ever heard of the Barbers, or at least where no one knew enough about the story to bother with it. Somewhere out west, I think. Bisbee, Arizona, maybe. Or California. Who knows? And in one of those places, one day he would have held his own son in his arms and looked down into that baby's eyes, as I did with Jacob many times, and wondered, "Who are you? What are you thinking?" "Are you all right, Mom?" "Of course. What are you doing? This is dangerous." 88, 89, 90. The minivan, a Honda Odyssey, was actually quite heavy. Not mini at all, its name notwithstanding. And it had a powerful engine. It was easy to speed. It felt very stable at high speeds. Driving it, I was often surprised to glance down at the speedometer and discover I was doing 80 or 85 miles an hour. But above 90, it began to shudder a little, and the wheels began to lose contact with the road. Mom? I love you, Jacob.
Jacob pressed himself back against his seat. His hands scrabbled for the seatbelt, but it was already too late. There were only a few seconds left. He still did not understand what was going on. His mind grasped at explanations for the speed, for Mom's bizarre calm. A jammed accelerator, a rush to avoid being late for the interview, or maybe her attention had just wandered.
I love you and your father both.
The minivan began to slip into the breakdown lane on the right side of the road, first the right wheels stepping over the line, then the left, only seconds remaining now, and continued to pick up speed as the road went down a little hill, assisting the engine, which was beginning to top out as the vehicle hit 96, 97, 98.
Mom, stop!
She launched the minivan directly at the bridge abutment. It was a molded concrete wall built into the side of a hill. The abutment was guarded by a jersey barrier, which ought to have guided the minivan away from a direct impact. But the vehicle was going too fast, and the angle of approach was too direct, so that when Lori edged into it, the jersey barrier lifted the right side wheels, causing the vehicle to skitter up the wall and, disastrously, to flip. Lori lost control of the car immediately, but she never let go of the steering wheel. The van scraped and skidded up the jersey barrier and vaulted off the top of it, its momentum catapulting it up into the air as it rolled three-quarters of the way to upside down, like a ship capsizing to its port side. With the minivan in the air, rolling counterclockwise, the engine racing, Lori screaming, a fraction of a second, that's all, Jacob would have thought of me, who had held him, my own baby. Look down into his eyes, and he would have understood I loved him, no matter what, to the very end, as he saw the concrete wall flying forward to meet him. This concludes the reading of Defending Jacob, a novel, by William Landay. Copyright 2012 by William Landay. This book was read by Grover Gardner. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with the Martell Agency and was produced in 2012 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.